Good morning. This is the time set for case number 55204, Doyle Barnett versus State. Ms. Bond for the appellant, Mr. Halstead for the respondent. Oh, this is Mr. It's Ms. Halstead. With that. Ms. Bond. We're very familiar with the facts of this case because we had the contempt situation with Judge Flanagan. So we know the facts, and we're just interested really in the potential errors that you've alleged in your appellant's brief.
Thank you, Justice Terry. Good morning, honorable members of the court, counsel. My name is Cheryl Bond. I'm with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Barnett, the appellant. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. There were six issues raised in the opening brief, and I would like to address two of those today and possibly touch on a third if there's time. The issues I would like to discuss are first, Detective Thomas's violation of NRS Chapter 239A, and second, Detective Thomas's testimony expressing his opinion about Mr. Barnett's guilt. The issue I would like to touch on third, if we have time, is the issue of the prior bad act. NRS 239A.080 prohibits the activities that Detective Thomas engaged in when he made the phone call to Mr. Barnett's bank to receive the records. I want to go directly to the issue here, and that is the interpretation of that statute. In his order, Judge Flanagan ruled against the defense and said that that information would come in. Where the language of the statute is plain and unambiguous, the language of the statute controls. It's plain and unambiguous that 239A.080 forbids Detective Thomas's conduct. In his order, Judge Flanagan noted that the state conceded that Detective Thomas violated that statute in his phone call. It's also plain and unambiguous that NRS 239A.180 renders such information inadmissible. The statute specifically says, evidence obtained in violation of any of the provisions of this chapter is inadmissible in any proceeding except a proceeding to enforce the provisions of this chapter.
Ms. Bond, let me ask you this. Let's say for the sake of argument we agreed with you. It was a wrong decision by Judge Flanagan. Wouldn't it be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the overwhelming evidence of Mr. Barnett's guilt, even without that credit card information, the fact that he took the merchandise out of the store, left the store, just the general circumstance, couldn't a jury have concluded that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of burglary based upon that?
It's absolutely not harmless. One of the key telling points about that is the prosecutor's own arguments during the hearing on the matter that without that information, they would be forced to dismiss the case. They had to have it in order to prosecute Mr. Barnett. Beyond that, the defense in the case was that Mr. Barnett had left his wallet outside with the credit card in it and was leaving the store to retrieve the wallet in order to pay for the goods.
Where were the goods when he left the store?
In the cart that he was pushing out. A secondary defense was that he had formed the intent to steal the items, to push the cart out and not pay for them after he'd already entered the store. So the evidence is not overwhelming against him at all, because if the jury had believed that he was pushing the items out, formed the intent to push the items out and not pay for them, then he would have been guilty of perhaps a petty larceny.
But the wallet evidence didn't come in.
I'm sorry?
The evidence that he was going outside to fetch his wallet did not come in. It was declared inadmissible.
A great deal of evidence about the wallet being outside did come in. There was enough presented through the testimony of Mr. Robles, who testified that when they were outside, Mr. Button approached and brought the wallet out. He also testified that they examined the wallet and found the credit card, but no cash in the wallet, which is what led to the credit card records coming in about whether the credit card was valid or not. That Ms. Ristenpart was able to argue the inference that Mr. Barnett had forgotten his wallet. There was some additional evidence as well, his manner throughout the store, that she used all to create inferences, that he was open and friendly and talking and not trying to hide his actions in going throughout the store, that he hesitated at the front. The state argued the inference that hesitation was looking for security. Ms. Ristenpart argued the inference that Mr. Barnett was looking for his friend because he realized his wallet had been left off and that he didn't have any means to pay for it at that point. So there was enough information in that there was the ability to argue to the jury that he had not formed the intent to steal prior to entering the store, or at the time he entered the store, the intent was not formed, that either he never intended to steal, he intended to get his wallet and pay for it, or he intended to steal only after he realized, I don't have my wallet, it's outside, I'm just going to steal this now. Either way, the evidence isn't overwhelming, and in addition, the prosecutor's own view of the case was that they had no case to go forward with without that evidence to assist in proving intent. I would like to note specifically about that statute that the district court judge clearly was torn in his order about the effects of the statute. He had decided that Detective Thomas had engaged in improper behavior, but he was seemed to be torn about, in the language of his order, what to do about it. And NRS 239A.180 specifically tells you what to do about it. The evidence is inadmissible. Judge
would
Flanagan...
Would that suggest then that the standard of review would not be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, but that we're dealing here with a purely statutory violation?
I believe it is a purely statutory violation, particularly since Judge Flanagan expressly said that he refused to construe the language of that statute in a way that would permit suppression of the evidence. I believe the phrase he used was, a constable's blunder should not let the guilty go free. And that's what we're arguing, is that he violated the plain reading of the statute, the plain meaning. Judge Flanagan went beyond the plain meaning of the statute to the legislative history. This court does not need to go there because the language is plain and unambiguous. But if you do go there, the legislative history also supports that the legislature knew full well from the testimony and letters, exhibits presented to the legislature about these concerns. This came into being through AB 63 in 1977. Washoe County District Attorney Hicks testified. Assistant District Attorney from Clark County, Beatty, provided a letter. Humboldt District Attorney McDonald provided a letter. And Secretary of State Securities Division head provided a letter, and his investigator attended the hearings. This is all in the legislative history. And in that, they discussed specifically that law enforcement would have to follow these provisions as well in investigating crime. They also specifically discussed the provision that would render the evidence inadmissible, and the legislature elected to enact the statute as written and not take this into account.
Right. Can I call your attention to another issue, because in the interest of time, during the penalty, or when the sentencing phase, when the judge found Mr. Barnett was a habitual criminal and the prior convictions were introduced, were they physically introduced into evidence? Were there, I know there was an issue if there was sufficiency of what was presented, but tell me the procedure. Did the judge have the hearing and they were marked and admitted into evidence as part of the court record there? Is that correct?
Yes, happened? Yes. Okay. At the hearing there were documents admitted. They were not, some were judgments of conviction on some of the convictions. Others were fingerprint cards, but there were paper records that were admitted that the judge looked at.
Okay.
At least three of them were felony convictions.
Yes, three of them were convictions. One of them was significantly older. I believe I outlined that in the briefing, that it was from, I believe it was 1984, and then there was one from 1994. I may have those dates slightly off, but there was one from the 80s and one from the 90s. And in discussing the one from the 1990s, the judge discussed whether that was remote. He crossed up the crimes. They were different crimes, and I'm blanking now on what they were, but it was burglary versus obtaining money by false pretenses or something along those lines. Different crimes, different years. He crossed those up. It wasn't clear which one he was talking about. It appeared, because he said the date, the 1994, I think, conviction, that that's the one he was discussing, but he never did discuss the one that was 10 years older, as whether it was too remote or how it affected the proceedings. And our point really there was that there were six priors listed on the information, one of which the judge discarded. He said it was a misdemeanor he wouldn't consider. In the paper documents presented on the other five, there were seven various charges listed in there. A great number of the documents presented were fingerprint cards from the California Department of Corrections that had his fingerprints on it when he was moved from one correctional facility to another. A lot of them were duplicative. Some of them had sentences listed as 6 months. Some of them had sentences listed not at all. One was from a mental health facility where he was receiving apparently some kind of mental health treatment. At least that's what it appeared from the paper document to be. But none of those had judgments of conviction with them, and none of them had anything from the court. They didn't have a docket sheet. They didn't have anything official from the court. It was from the Department of Correction. And while there were three, the bare line minimum, admitted, more than half of what he said he considered and based his decision on weren't proper convictions. And because it's not automatic when you reach three, because he has to balance what he's doing to decide whether it's the appropriate thing to do in judging a defendant, a habitual criminal, the fact that more than half of what he relied on was not a valid basis to rely upon should render that decision suspect, and it should go back for, at a minimum, new sentencing hearing.
What about the recusal issue that you raised? The recusal.
The bias issue of Judge Flanagan?
Yes.
That's tied in pretty heavily to the argument in Ristenpart versus State that this court already heard from Mr. Petty and Mr. Hattelstadt. The way it ties in is that was solely about the contempt aspect, of course, of his finding against Ms. Ristenpart. But it also ties into the reflections of what happened in the actual case with Mr. Barnett. It was demonstrated, the bias of the judge was demonstrated in a number of different orders. In his order initially on NRS 239A, he used some intemperate language initially. He was, in his own explanation later on the record, he was in a rush to file that. He was bristling at the absurdity of a legal argument that NRS 239A ought to be followed. He later admitted that that was intemperate language, he should not have used that language, that it did not reflect a considered decision. The fact that he was in such a hurry to file an order leveling his own expression of contempt at defense counsel is a huge indicator that his goal was not to reach the order in the case, not to reach the considered decision, but to push this order out there saying, I can't believe you would raise such an issue in front of me. I bristle at the absurdity with that. That's an indication of bias. He's not making a considered decision by his own admission.
What about him hearing the motion about his, what's your position on that?
The proper procedure would be for it to have been sent, as it was the second time, to the chief judge for a different judge to hear it. Mm-hmm. And the chief judge, Connie Steinheimer, heard it on the second occasion that the motion to recuse was raised. And she indicated in that hearing the proper procedure would have been for it to be referred to her so that he wasn't hearing his own case. He should not have heard his own, the motion to recuse on himself for personal bias. In addition, she also noted that the proper procedure once the original trial had gone off would have been to send it back to the original department. It was randomly assigned to Department 10, Judge Elliott. It got moved for court congestion. The original trial date went off, and instead of moving it back as Second Judicial District Court rules would anticipate back to Department 10, Judge Flanagan kept it and reset the trial date in front of himself. And kept
so what do we do when a judge does that? As an appellate court, what do we do in a criminal case?
Well, in this case, it's an indication of the bias that he had, and we would ask you to send it back for a new trial, either back to the randomly assigned court Department 10 or back for a new random assignment excluding Judge Flanagan in this particular case. That's what we would ask this court to do as a remedy.
You've got about 2.5 minutes left. You want to reserve the rest?
Yes, I would like to reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Halstead, on behalf of the DA's office, State of Nevada.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patricia Halstead. I'm arguing this on behalf of the state. I was the actual trial counsel. So if you have any questions with regard to those proceedings, I was there and would be happy to answer them for you. Starting with the credit cards, there's a couple things I want to address in argument. There was a statement that the state conceded that the case wouldn't have had been able to go forward had those credit card records not been admitted. That was never my position. I think that was something that might have taken from something that Mr. Hall argued in the motions hearing because I happened to be out of town. My position was always that that crime occurred the minute Mr. Barnett entered, and regardless of whether he would have had $200 in his wallet in cash, the crime occurs at the time he entered the Raley's, and that's when the intent was formed, and that's when the burglary occurred. With regard to the overwhelming...
What's the evidence of the intent when he enters? What separates this case from a petty larceny case?
The overwhelming evidence in this case is, first of all, it was all on video. So there was the video shown at the court. It showed him handing Mr. Button his backpack when he initially went into the store. The video showed them standing outside. He hands him his backpack, and then he goes into the store. He grabs a cart. He starts putting things in the cart. You see him go to opposite end of the registers, look around, and then he does what was described as the classic push-out, where he just pushes the cart out through the doors. At that point, you saw security on the video approach him. My concern with the hearsay was the hearsay is not admissible. Hey, I forgot my wallet. You know, buddy, bring me my wallet. That can be admitted. The actions, of course, were that his buddy, Mr. Button, walked over, hands him his back, hands, takes the wallet, hands him the wallet to the security people, and then they go back in. Well, that's after it's already been committed and he's done it, and then we get into the wallet and we see there's an invalid credit card and no means of payment. Well, that helps my case, but that doesn't prove my case. And then what I have to bolster that is I have the phone calls, the jail phone calls, where he says, when he's talking to Mr. Button right after he's arrested, they got me. And he says it more colorful than that, but he says they got me. And the context of that is a specific reference to the burglary charge. They said, what, if you heard those calls, they would have said, what were you arrested for? Burglary and petty larceny. And he's referencing the burglary and the petty larceny. You don't have the benefit of those calls, but it's referenced on volume 5 on page 118, where Detective Thomas clarifies in the record that that was a specific reference to the burglary. So defendant himself acknowledges that. It's all on video. You have the testimony of Mr. Robles. So that was overwhelming, and it was clear, and it wasn't just the petty larceny. Because you also have Mr. Button stating he always keeps his wallet in his backpack. If he doesn't have his backpack, it's in his pocket. But even his own friend says his wallet's always in his backpack, and what does he do? He gives him his backpack before he goes in. So that's what separates this case. With regard to the credit card records,
could you clarify for me what is in the record with respect to the jailhouse telephone call?
It was an actual CD recording of the call that was admitted through Detective Thomas, and the call was played for the court.
But you didn't include that as part of the record on appeal?
I didn't personally, no.
So it's not part of the record on appeal?
No, but and that's why I referenced you to the reference to it in Volume 5, because it is in the record on appeal with regard to...
But if we're adopting a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard to review the sufficiency of the evidence minus the credit card piece... The absence of that is significant to our review. You can't just say it's there. We needed to have it.
Well, and that's why I point you to Volume 5, page 18, because it's the context of it. It's in the testimony.
The contents are given there?
Yeah, he doesn't quote it very far, but he referenced it, and the specific statement is referenced, and the fact that it was a reference to the burglary is contained within the testimony from Detective Thomas. And again,
that was during the trial, that testimony.
That's during the trial, and it's at Volume 5, page 118. So that should help with regard to that.
You can bring the physical evidence up here. I mean, the tape cassette could have come.
Is it? Well, I don't know if it's too late to supplement it. That's something I would be happy to do. With regard to the standard for suppressing the credit card records, I would submit to you that the district court didn't find that what Detective Thomas did it was anything wrong. He said this is what detectives do. They make initial phone calls. They call to see if credit cards are valid. Because say a defendant invokes their right to trial in 60 days, you've got a short window that you've got to get these records. So what you want to do is just some initial investigation. Do I want to go through all this work to get this if the credit card's valid? If it's not valid, it helps, but it doesn't make or break the case. Detective Thomas was very clear in his testimony about that. Again, he said it was just another piece of the puzzle. It doesn't make or break the case. So he makes an initial call.
Does that excuse the statutory violation that he'll only go for a warrant if he knows ahead of time that it's worth pursuing?
Well, I think what it does is it puts it in context. And so the reason I want to bring it up is to tie it to the fact that if you're going to exclude evidence, it's the least favorable remedy, and so you have to put it in violation of the context. So is a simple call to a credit card company to see if you need to go through all the process of getting a search warrant, doing out-of-state process. In this case, we had to figure out how the other state would accept out-of-state process. It didn't take the initial 6 months. That time did attenuate it, as I would submit to you and as the district court found. But
let's see, are you stating that if, in fact, it turned out that it was Brady material, that the credit card was good, he wouldn't have done anything with it? He wouldn't have gotten the evidence?
No, I'm not submitting that. I think it would have been in his report either way. And that's how it came to light, was because it was in his report. He wasn't hiding the ball. He said, I called this credit card company. He wasn't trying to do anything unreasonable. He's just doing what detectives do. Probably, I submit to you, not aware of the statute. If you read through the record, Chief Deputy District Attorney Hall, who does a lot of elder exploitation cases and deals with bank records quite often, didn't know about the statute. So I commend defense for finding it, but it's not something that usually comes to light or that anyone really knew of. So he just called to check on the status of a credit card. It was a simple call. So then you have to ask, well, is it reasonable to suppress that evidence in light of the considerations of suppressing? When you go back through case law, Herring in particular, it says the benefit of suppressing evidence can't be just marginal or non-existent. It may be admissible under a good faith rule. Well, was Detective Thomas acting in good faith here?
Why have the statute? If you got a statute, why have the statute if the police are going to violate it?
Well, just like any other statute, just like Miranda, you have it because you need it. But what are the basis of Miranda, for example? If you go through Miranda, they talk about people being left without counsel for hours, people being interrogated while they're standing, people being denied of their rights, not allowed to talk to their counsel. You have these rules because of intentional violations of people's rights. We don't have an intentional violation here. So then you look at the balancing test. Do you want to exclude this just for a simple, perhaps negligent act? Herring says you can't do that. It says it has to be intentional. It has to be damaging, the specific.
Well, can we infer that it was intentional by the way this detective testified against Mr. Barnett? When he didn't hesitate to say he was guilty and usurped the jury function in this matter?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that's what his testimony. That comes from that Wisconsin law. If you look that up, the Wisconsin law specifically says that it has to be, and let me read it so I get it right. A direct opinion about the accused's guilt. And so it can't be something that merely puts the evidence in context or assists the jury in resolving a factual issue placed before it. Every officer has to believe that a defendant committed a crime. They can't make an arrest if they don't think the defendant committed a crime. They have to have PC, they have to have evidence to back it up, and they have to be able to state that, and they have to be able to explain that to the jury. So just saying these are the things that led me to believe the defendant committed burglary is not out and out saying defendant is guilty because he did these things. And that's what that Wisconsin statute says, and that's not what Detective Thomas did here. So to mix that up would be apples and oranges and then put a police officer in a position on the stand that he couldn't comment on the evidence or put it in context or explain why that officer found, in this case, that the appellant actually committed the burglary. And that's part of his job. That's what he's got to place on the stand, because you can't arrest someone if you don't think that they did it. So it's really an unfair standard if you take it out of context. That's why Wisconsin requires that it be a direct comment on the guilt. And we just don't have that here. And then even assuming that he did do that, there's another step. You have to find that there would have been material prejudice to a substantial right. So it's a twofold question. You can't just say he did it. You also have to find that it would have been material prejudice to a substantial right.
We're looking at this case closely because we're going to be supporting this guy for the rest of his life, you know, at about $23,000 a year since he's now a habitual criminal. And he stole $160 worth of stuff, you know.
Well, and
you
know,
that's why we're giving you maybe what you'd consider a tough time. But, you know, I like the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And when I was a defense attorney, I liked when the DA would say, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened, without any type of witness, whether it be a professional witness like a police officer or just a lay witness giving an opinion as to guilt or innocence.
Well, and let me address that concern with you, because I hear that as a concern about the habitual criminal status. And I think it's important to clear up that there were the five exhibits. They're in the volume that's marked as Exhibit 8, and they were all marked and admitted. Now, if you actually go through the record at Volume 1, page 21 through 22, the court says that he only considered Exhibits 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so the ones that are, you hear the respondent call the fingerprint cards, even though they were briefed, and I sort of should have looked at the record before I continued to brief that, but if you actually look at the record and what was considered, those weren't considered by the district court. So you have five felony convictions, and I just want to talk to you about those briefly because I see I only have a few minutes left. The first was a 1984 grand larceny for which he was given 6 years. Now, that started as a residential burg, and the owner ended up holding the appellant at gunpoint. That's in the record. That's in the documents you have. He was represented by counsel, so it's presumptively valid. He wasn't even in for 6 years. Only 5 years later, he's got an 89 conviction for a burglary. That as well was a home burglary, but pursuant to negotiation, they struck the language that it was an occupied dwelling. He was also, again, represented by counsel. There was proof of sentencing on page 36 of volume 8 at page 36 and 103. and the plea agreement was reached in that case. That was 89, and that was a four-year sentence. And then, just a few years later, after that served, you have Exhibit 5, you have the 94 burglary, which wasn't considered by the court. There was also a 76 burglary that was within that packet. None of that the district court considered. But then the next one was Exhibit 1, and you have a 96 grand larceny. And that was a 72-month sentence, which is up to 6 years, where he sold stereo equipment at Kmart. And then you have Exhibit 3, which was an 05 attempted grand larceny, 12 to 36 months. And that was, again, just not long after, well, it was a long time from the 96 to the 05. But then you have the 08. So basically for 24 years, what we have is a span of 24 years where no matter what we do to this appellant, no matter how long we put him in prison, no matter what we do, he goes in to homes, to businesses, and he takes things. It doesn't matter if it's tequila. It doesn't matter if it's chicken. What matters is that he meets the definition of a habitual criminal. This is someone you can't fix. He's always going to cost us money. He's always going to cost us time. And these aren't victimless crimes. As was pointing out in the sentencing, you have to hire security personnel. Food costs rise. You have people in the store not feeling safe because you have security running around chasing people. And like I said, the overwhelming evidence in this shows that this was his intentional act. So with
regard- Just to bolster your argument, I see in his Petrocella hearing he admitted he's, the question was, how many times do you think you've stolen things out of stores? And he answered several times. And then somebody asked probably 15 or 20 times, and he said maybe. So I understand we're not dealing with, number one, the smartest guy in the world, or the brightest bulb on the tree, and also it sounds like he's a thief. So it does support your argument there on the habitual criminal.
And with regard to that, that was brought up in the briefing, and I just want to make sure that was clear that that was at the Petrocelli hearing.
Yes, we understood that.
In front of the jury. And that was brought up in context of comparing his credibility with that of Joey Robles. So
it does bolster your position, though.
Thank you, Your Honor. So if there's any other of the things I haven't talked on, I'd be happy to touch those with you. If not, I'll just go through them again briefly.
Can I ask you this on the credit card issue and the call? Did you make the argument to the district court, something like an inevitable discovery argument, that you would have found out eventually the credit card wasn't any good, whether he called or the officer called or not, or did that ever even come up in district court?
That inevitable discovery was brought up. And another point that hasn't been briefed actually at all in the reply briefing, was the fact that when there's sufficient evidence in a search warrant, minus the one thing that appellant takes issue with, we had all these facts that supported the granting of the search warrant, and then there was the reference, yeah, and I want to confirm what the credit card told me. Take out that, I want to confirm what the credit card company told me, and you still have sufficient evidence to support the search warrant. And there's case law that upholds search warrants where there's ample information independent of what that, which is contested to furnish probable cause. That's important because it's an easy thing to hang your hat on, which hasn't been briefed by defense, and it's a legal basis that supports upholding the search warrant. Again, he wasn't trying to hide the ball. This was not, and I want to go back to that language because to be excluded, there has to be a certain finding of some very bad conduct, and I want to make sure I quote that.
I think if we give Detective Thomas the benefit of the doubt that you're correct about that, that even though he violated the statute in good faith, if he was trying to get that information, it certainly would have hindered your case if that credit card was good. And if he, in fact, had given it to the public defender's office, that would have certainly been to their benefit and to Barnett's benefit. So I understand what you're saying. There is an issue of good faith here. I see that.
I have a point of clarification. On the exhibits that were considered by the district court in sentencing, they were 1, 2, 3, and 4. What is the state's position with respect to Exhibit 2? I understood in the briefing that you maintained that that was properly considered, but did I hear you in argument say that it was not?
No, it was Exhibit 5.
Exhibit 5, okay.
Yeah, Exhibit 5 was what respondent had referred to as the Department of Corrections packet.
Okay, and so you no longer defend the consideration of Exhibit 5, but it wasn't considered anyway?
What happened is defendant was being brought out. The district courts had him brought back in and said, I want to clarify that what I've considered for the habitual criminal is Exhibits 1, 2, 3, and 4. Exhibit 1 was the 96 grand larceny. Exhibit 2 was the 89 California burglary. Exhibit 3 was the 05 grand larceny, and Exhibit 4 was the 84 grand larceny. So the one that you've heard about in argument today from appellant pursuant to the court was not considered.
Okay.
Does that clarify that for you?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Halstead.
Thank you.
Yes, thank
you. I want to go straight to the habitual criminal exhibit issue. Volume 1, page 114 to 115 of the joint appendix, the judge says he's considering Exhibits 1 through 5 and not considering Exhibit 6. I understand that the respondent has said that he later clarified that, but a good portion of the judge's discussion is about the 1994 exhibit and how that's not remote and he's going to consider it. And he talks about that greatly, and that's in Exhibit 5. So clearly he did consider Exhibit 5. Perhaps he later changed his mind and realized, oh, those are fingerprint cards, I shouldn't consider them. But it was clear when he made his original decision, he was considering Exhibit 5. And I'd ask the court to just go back to the record. Volume 1, pages 114 to 115 are where he has that discussion. And I believe it's at, yes, page 115 is the discussion of the 1994 burglary, where he describes it as the 1994 burglary, although he calls it Exhibit 2, I believe, which is, he calls it the exhibit that is the 1989, but it's really the 1994 that he's talking about because he describes it that way. As to Detective Thomas's testimony, it's not an unfair standard to prevent the police from telling the jury he's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty. It's in the Constitution. You get a jury trial, not a trial by detective. So he can describe what he knows and what the facts are without saying, and he's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty. When you have, it is a direct opinion by the officer, when you have a police officer who's supposed to represent truth, justice, and the American way, sitting on the witness stand saying repeatedly, I examined the facts because I'm a detective and this is what I do, and he's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty. He crawled right up in the jury box and he said, don't bother to deliberate, I've done it for you. He's guilty, and that's unacceptable. I also want to touch on the credit card issue. It's not inevitable discovery. And the reason it's not inevitable discovery is that the detective relied upon the information he got in the telephone call. Had the search warrant relied upon the defendant saying, oh yeah, I knew it wasn't valid, or oh no, it's not my credit card, or I know I'm over limit, that might have given a probable cause. Had the store run the credit card and been declined, it might have given a probable cause. But what he had was the information from the telephone call, and that's the essence of the detective's affidavit. So it wouldn't have inevitably been discovered absent the illegal telephone call. In addition, the prosecutor said, I'm sorry, Ms. Halstead said, Detective Thomas was just doing what detectives do according to the judge's order. I hope not, because he committed a misdemeanor. So I hope they don't routinely commit misdemeanors in order to convict other people of $195 thefts. That's appalling to me, that would just be something detectives do, so it's okay. The fact that the statute specifically provides it's to be excluded gives you the remedy. It's not a balancing test. The statute says you violate this, it has to be excluded. So we would ask this court to reverse its conviction.
Thank you to Ms. Bond and Ms. Halstead. This case will stand submitted. Your arguments were interesting. Your briefs were excellent.